unlike many armies in the world, you came not to conquer, not to occupy, but to liberate. And the Iraqi people know this.
People have been injured by some unexploded ordnance, and we are, to be honest, very much scared.
War crimes have been committed, then the U.S. should put on trial those who committed these war crimes.
I was conflicted coming home with so much anger about what we've done in Baghdad, what we've done in Iraq.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, April 30th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush will address the nation tomorrow evening from the deck of an aircraft carrier to say that major combat in Iraq has ended. But White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer says the president will neither declare victory in so many words nor declare the war to be over. Bush will make the speech from the deck of the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln as it steams towards San Diego. Fleischer said the speech will be given while the carrier is still more than 100 miles off the California coast. He will address the nation just as he did at the beginning of the conflict, said Fleischer, and he said the White House has requested time from the television networks to broadcast the speech. It will be the first time that a president has spoken to the nation from the deck of a moving carrier. He will speak at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The Arab press is reporting that the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein could address the Iraqi people within 72 hours. Meanwhile, opposition leader Abdel Amir al-Rakabi told al-Bawaba by telephone from his office in Paris that the Iraqi people's resistance against the American forces has been growing. He revealed that 20 U.S. soldiers were killed and 10 armored carriers were destroyed amid what he claimed was a media blackout imposed by Washington on such reports. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld addressed U.S. troops in Baghdad today, once again extolling the virtues of U.S. forces. He spoke about the newly delivered freedom of the Iraqi people, even as protests raged throughout Iraq toward the presence of U.S. and British troops. Rumsfeld gave a description of the sensitivity of U.S. military forces toward Iraqi civilians, while the civilian body count in Iraq is at least 2,100 thus far. A smiling Rumsfeld described the brutal invasion as possibly the fastest march on a capital in modern military history.
Unlike many armies in the world, you came not to conquer, not to occupy, but to liberate. And the Iraqi people know this. And when you arrived in Baghdad, many of the Iraqi people came into the streets to welcome you, celebrating their newfound freedom. You've unleashed events that will unquestionably shape the course of this country, a fate of a people, and very likely affect the future of this entire region. You, our coalition partners, took such great care to protect the lives of innocent civilians. We want the Iraqi people to live in freedom so that they can build a future where Iraqi leaders answer to the Iraqi people instead of killing them. And because of you, they will have a chance to do just that. And we have to help provide conditions of stability and security so that the Iraqi people can form an interim authority and then ultimately a free Iraqi government based on political freedom, individual liberty, and the rule of law.
Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld. There was no mention of U.S. troops who opened fire on about 1,000 anti-American demonstrators in the city of Fallujah for the second time this week. According to Reuters News Service, the troops reported that they had been fired upon by the crowd first and were defending themselves. Three Iraqis were killed and another 15 injured. Well, this week's multiple shootings of Iraqi civilians are not the only potential war crimes of which U.S. occupation troops are being accused. Jan Furman, a Brussels-based attorney, is filing suit on behalf of more than a dozen Iraqi plaintiffs, charging U.S. military commander General Tommy Franks with war crimes and violations of the Geneva Convention under Belgium's war crimes law under the principle of universal jurisdiction. The prospect of a U.S. general joining the ranks of other defendants, such as Generals Ariel Sharon of Israel and Augusto Pinochet of Chile, aroused the wrath of the State Department, which warned Belgium of severe consequences if indictments are issued against American troops and officers. Peace Watch producer Robert Knight spoke today with prosecuting attorney Jan Furman about the war crimes litigation.
At this time, there are 19 persons who are filing a complaint. They were victims in 17 different incidents. And these incidents go from deliberately shooting at civilians, use of cluster bombs against civilian areas, to gunfire on ambulances.
Where did the cluster bomb incidents take place?
All of these incidents we are specifically targeting have been taking place in the area of Baghdad.
You say there have been assaults on medical personnel and ambulances.
Yes.
Was that also in Baghdad? And can you describe any of those incidents in any detail so people can understand what charges are being made here?
One of the incidents is an incident in which an ambulance transporting three wounded persons from one hospital to another because they could not be taken care of in the hospital where they were by the lack of facilities, was approaching a roadblock and was fired at by a tank. The driver of the ambulance was shot in the back. The person who was sitting next to him was wounded in the leg. People that were the patients that were in the back of the ambulance, one of them died. The second one was very severely wounded. One of the patients got an additional he had already a shot wound, and he had got an additional shot wound during this incident in the thorax.
Which international laws deny that kind of behavior?
The Geneva Conventions on the protection of civilians in the in international armed conflicts, and it's also the Belgian law on universal jurisdiction, which specifically says that war crimes targeting civilians and medical personnel in a war is considered as a war crime and can be prosecuted before Belgian courts on the basis of this war, on this law repressing international serious violations of international humanitarian rights.
Who are the defendants that you are seeking to indict and charge with these crimes?
At this point, unidentified military personnel, because, for example, those who shot at the ambulance, of course, we don't know their identity. And one of the aims of the inquiry the victims want to be conducted is precisely to identify those who were responsible for these acts. The other aspect is, of course, that some of the incidents, at least, for example, the use of cluster bombs, cannot have been done without the superior command at least being informed. The Belgian law on repression of serious violations of international humanitarian law foresees not only a responsibility for those who commit the war crime, not only for those who order the war crime to be committed, but also for those who do not take every possible action to stop it from being committed. And that's where, of course, a command responsibility comes in. It's not only the responsibility of the individual soldier or the on the field, it's also the responsibility of those who were in command. And that's why the campaign will also be pointing at General Tommy Franks.
The commander of the United States troops in Iraq.
Yes.
There was a very strong reaction in the United States when a spokesperson for the White House said that because of your lawsuit, if indictments are issued, that the nation of Belgium would pay diplomatically and in other ways if this prosecution goes forward. Is the prosecution going forward?
Well, I don't know how the Belgian government will, or the Belgian judiciary will react to that. That's difficult for me to say. We are anyhow preparing the lawsuits, which will be filed in a few days. We are now working on all the materials we got, all the witness statements, all the statements of the victims. And these will be presented anyhow to the Office of the National Prosecutor. And I think we have a strong case because it's very It's undeniable that some of the events we are pointing out are war crimes, and it's also undeniable that an inquiry is possible because there is a lot of possibilities to, to interrogate witnesses which are out of Iraq now. So even if the U.S. doesn't allow a Belgian magistrate to go to Iraq to do the investigation, to conduct the investigation, then still it's possible to conduct a very serious investigation on the basis of other sources. So according to Belgian law, the judiciary should accept to conduct such an inquiry. And it's very strange to me that the U.S. actually, or the U.S. administration, the present administration, actually even is opposed to an inquiry, because a lawsuit or a complaint being filed means that, an independent magistrate will have to conduct such an inquiry. So it's very strange to me that a country or an administration would threaten the executive of another country if their independent judiciary, on which the Belgian executive even shouldn't have any influence, even if independent judiciary decides to make an inquiry, to investigate. An investigation is, of course, a different problem from a final conviction in a court. So this standpoint from the U.S. administration seems extremely strange, extremely unacceptable to me. Normally, if allegations about war crimes committed by U.S. military personnel were made, the U.S. should be very happy that an inquiry is conducted. And if the inquiry shows that indeed war crimes have been committed, then the U.S. should put on trial those who committed these war crimes. I understand from this very strong reaction of the State Department that not only they don't have any intention to do the work themselves, but that even if somebody else tries to do the work and tries to conduct an independent inquiry, he will be submitted to pressure from the State Department, which I think is not a normal thing to do in a civilized nation.
Belgian attorney Jan Furman, who will present war crime charges against General Tommy Franks to a prosecutor within the next 2 weeks. He spoke with Robert Knight, host of Wake Up Call on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. In the face of rising anti-American sentiments in Iraq, U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says that humanitarian agencies are leaving Iraq because there is no humanitarian crisis. But the International Committee of the Red Cross says there is a state of emergency, and humanitarian groups are leaving because of a total breakdown of civil infrastructure. Yesterday, Peace Watch spoke with Nada Dumani, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, regarding the humanitarian situation in Iraq. Today, we continue that conversation as she specifically addresses the question of health conditions in Baghdad and the legacy of cluster bombs used by U.S. forces.
I would say that now we are no more in a state of emergency, if we can put it this way. There are no more life-saving activities in general since the hospitals have stopped, and now hospitals don't have to cope with war-wounded people, etc. But we shouldn't forget that there are people suffering from chronic diseases, from diabetes, or who need dialysis and things like that, or more specific medicines. And in that respect, there is a shortage of insulin, for instance, in the country. There is a shortage of vaccines for the children. UNICEF was in charge of making campaigns in order for measles, polio, meningitis, all the usual things that they do to children. And now there is a shortage of these specific vaccines and of some medicines. And regularly, hospitals are short of some equipment. Today, we mentioned this Fallujah incident, the hospital where we went to. They didn't have any anesthetic drugs, and so we had to provide them with some. They were starting to lack from oxygen, and we'll provide them with oxygen too. We have regularly to provide hospitals with things that are lacking. So I don't know how you would characterize that situation.
Well, the scarcity of insulin and vaccines and equipment and the lack of oxygen that you just articulated, that has been, I assume, exacerbated in the aftermath of this war. Or was that a situation that perhaps existed to some degree even before the invasion of Baghdad by the U.S.?
Well, definitely. I mean, it has been exacerbated. Now, there has been, as you know, a lot of medical equipment and medicine have been looted on one hand. And as I said, hospitals are not functioning, operating as they used to. There is also a lack of medical staff. Now, if we think about certain medicines such as vaccines, you need a cool chain. You need to bring them from outside, but you need to keep them all the time, store them in cool places. And when you have power cuts regularly, one doctor came today from Alawiya Hospital, which is a pediatric hospital, and he told me that most of the vaccine they had has been depleted, and some medicines have been depleted because of lack of electricity and no way to store them in a cool place.
Nada Dumani, we have seen reports that, and we know that the U.S. has been using cluster bombs through this military operation. Have you personally seen the evidence of these cluster bombs? Have you worked on patients? Can you describe for our audience what kind of an impact these bombs have on victims in a war area like this?
As you mentioned, the Americans, I think, stated it publicly. The British also said it publicly that they've used cluster bombs in certain areas. And we ourselves didn't investigate so far on this matter precisely. We are not taking care directly of injured people, but we have heard converging reports that in some cases there have been people have been injured by some unexploded ordnance. And we are, to be honest, very much scared, and we are worried that there must be a lot of explosive remnants of war, and this will be a problem for on the long term. I mean, it will remain a problem for years as these unexploded ordnance are still in the country. The problem with cluster bombs is that they can stay on the site for months and sometimes for years and then explode. And then we will have victims mainly in a few years because of the cluster bombs that have been used during this war.
So what would cause them to explode? Would they need to come into contact with something, or would they just explode spontaneously?
Well, I'm not a military expert, but as far as I understood, some of these cluster bombs, they need, for instance, you need to rotate them a certain number of time and then they would explode, or to touch them a certain number of time and then they detonate after, they are programmed to detonate after a certain number of rotations. And so if they just fell on the ground at some point and then somebody comes and play with them because they have some kind of a leash on the top, then they can explode after a few rotations.
Nada Dumani, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, speaking to Peace Watch from Baghdad, Iraq. The debate over who will control Iraq and what kind of government it will end up with is growing hotter and hotter. At the heart of this debate is the question of who will actually control the oil in a country that enjoys the world's second largest oil reserves. Even after almost 20 years of war and sanctions, Iraq is able to simply open the taps and restart full-fledged production at any time. But just who will run this operation and where will the money go? Ula Ferwati has more from Dubai, the United Arab Emirates.
The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries' decision last week to scale back oil production by 2 million barrels per day in anticipation of Iraq's strong return to the oil scene has generated mixed reactions around the world. An old debate about the sanction hit, war-torn countries' ability to flip the picture of world oil markets was again given ammunition. Oil, which one American army official called the Central Bank of Iraq, will definitely pay for the reconstruction of the country. And in terms of infrastructure, Iraq is doing just fine. Kate Durian is director of the United Arab Emirates Office of Platts, the Global Oil News Service.
There hasn't been as much damage as people thought there would be to the Iraqi oil fields. The U.S.-led coalition now says that they are in control of all the oil fields and that they are hoping to start production from the oil fields in a few weeks' time. The fear of Saddam Hussein burning the oil wells didn't really happen. There were only a few fires in the south, in the southern Rumaila oil field. There have been no fires reported in the north. So the infrastructure has actually survived, even though it's not in very good shape. The main issue now is who actually is the legality of who can sell the oil.
The Americans have implied that they might unilaterally sell the oil once an interim Iraqi administration is in place. The London-based Global Center of Energy Studies believes Iraq will adopt a fast-track development policy that will enable it to re-attain its pre-Kuwait invasion capacity of 3.5 barrels a day at a cost of around $5 billion over a three-year span. For the country to develop up to 4.5 million barrels a day by tapping into undeveloped reserves with the help of international oil companies, it will need around $30 billion over a 10-year span. Durian, however, believes some work still has to be done.
At the same time, Iraq has been involved in has been under sanctions for the last 10 years, so there has been no investment, modern equipment. They have been using very questionable techniques to keep the pressure in their oil wells going. Some of the wells are in decline. They had the Iran-Iraq war before that, which also knocked out some installations. Iraq, before the war began, was selling oil under the humanitarian program, the Oil for Food program, that they agreed with the United Nations. And that UN resolution has not been scrapped. It still exists. And so any oil sales post-war Iraq will still have to be done through the Oil for Food program, which was signed with the Iraqi government at the time. So there are very interesting legal issues that have to be resolved.
Not only does Iraq have enormous oil reserves, but the process of drilling and producing oil in that country is comparatively much easier than in many other oil-producing spots around the world. According to informed experts, oil companies worldwide are running over each other's backs to get their share of the pie. Hassan Nwez is chairman of Emirates, a giant company in the United Arab Emirates that has been in the oil business for over 20 years.
As you know, in this part of the world, the oil is controlled by the government. But our company deal with the services side. We supply equipment, material, we provide services to the oil and gas companies.
Are you interested?
Of course we are interested. We are looking at the possible potential for providing similar services and similar equipment and material, which we do here, to the oil and gas companies, which will invest in Iraq.
At this stage, we'd like to wait and see. I need to see to get the comfort that things are under control.
As for who should be doing the job, there's complete unanimity among experts and officials that Iraqis are more than qualified to do it, as Durian points out.
I think the ideal situation is that the people who have been running Iraq's oil industry under very, very severely difficult circumstances should be allowed to continue to do it, because only they know how to do it with the help of the major oil companies, because they will need, I mean, don't forget, Iraq has not been in a position to have access to new technology. I mean, technology has moved so far since Iraq was cut off from the world that you have new techniques that can maximize oil production from a certain well. They have horizontal drilling, they have three-dimensional surveys. I mean, there is so much that can be done now with technology, and you need the oil majors to do it. You need big companies. And also there is this whole issue of all the companies that had either signed deals with Iraq, with the former Iraqi government, like Russia's Lukoil, like Chinese companies. There are Vietnamese companies, there are Tunisian companies, Total was negotiating with the Iraqi government, with the previous Iraqi government, on development of one of the biggest fields in Iraq. So all these matters have to be resolved before you can actually go ahead and start developing these fields, because there are so many undeveloped fields, there is so much work to be done, and the Iraqis are not going to be able to do it alone. But I think that in overall charge, it should be the Iraqis because, as I said, only they know how to manage their own resources.
In Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, this is Ola Farawati for Pacifica's Peace Watch.
At the National Press Club here in the nation's capital this morning, Executive Director of the UN Office of the Iraq Program, Binan Sivan, discussed renewed concerns about the export of oil under the Oil for Food Program. Reviewing the UN Oil for Food Program, which is funded entirely by revenue from oil exported under its guidance, Sivan opened by reacting to accusations of bloat and inefficiency. The accusations were cast while the UN tries to get the program moving in face of debate in the Security Council, and in the wake of the Anglo-American invasion of Iraq. The head of the UN's Iraq program went on to bemoan restrictions placed on the humanitarian aid workers imposed not by the UN Secretary General, but by member states of the Security Council, with the U.S. being the prominent force in that body. Sivan didn't let the Iraqi government escape his criticism either.
And the famous 2.2%, which everybody talks about, goes to the UN operational and administrative costs. In fact, that 2.2% account became of a lesser percentage because under instruction of Secretary General, we insisted to bring about economies of scale and also in terms of our administrative costs. We managed to save $272 million, which went back to the program for the purchase of additional humanitarian supplies. And I'd like to challenge any one of you, as I did the other day, to come up with, to me with the name of a single American company or any company which operates on 2.2% overhead costs. The unfortunate thing was, of course, you have to remember that this program was being implemented under a very strict, very rigorous sanctions regime. We were tied down with all sorts of rules, regulations. You could have five items sometimes, which were important, arriving, and yet one item you could not import because it is considered to be dual usage. I couldn't carry out local procurement, not because I didn't want to do it. There was a bumper crop of wheat last year, the year before. But we couldn't buy it because of the rules, regulations set by the Security Council. This is the reason why we keep importing all the way from Australia wheat. It was not just the strings attached by the Security Council, but also the strings attached by the government of Iraq, which was not an easy place to work. Under the sanctions, the people of Iraq became more and more reliant on the government of Iraq for their day-to-day lives. I'm not talking about political lives, but for their survival. Because every single Iraqi, I said, received this basket. In fact, they became a basket case. Over 90% of the population relied for their food supply on the basket. And for the 60%, I'd like to clarify, it was not just that they relied on the food basket in total, no. It was their main source of income, that they had to sell or barter part of it in order to get other essential needs, no matter what decision the Security Council may wish to take. To modify or to end, this is their prerogative, the program. But whatever decisions may be taken, I like to appeal is that they are introduced gradually. One has to admire the resilience of the Iraqi people who have suffered so much for over 20 years. And the sooner they are given the opportunity to run their own business, the sooner they are given the confidence that they own their own natural resources, including oil, the better it will be for their freedom. And I like to hope, to wish to hope that as soon as possible, oil also starts exported soon, because every single day which passes without oil export, it costs the people of Iraq $55 million.
When asked about former Oil for Food official Dennis Halliday's resignation in protest of the U.S.-imposed sanctions and their consequences on Iraqi civilians, Sivan responded emotionally and critically. Also during the question and answer session, he expressed more of his frustration with the pace of events, but was optimistic that the program would resume shortly.
It is very easy to resign and go and walk away. And you make the news for what, 5 minutes, 10 minutes? And what do you gain out of it? Let's be frank about it. Sanctions were never imposed as a reward for good behavior. In the meantime, the Council also recognized that you cannot impose such a strict sanctions and not expect that the people are going to suffer. This is the reason why they came up with the program. It will take 2 months, 3 months, but I'm surprised because at the same time they keep saying that most of the oil wells were not damaged. You know. So if that's the case, it can be faster, I'm sure.
Executive Director of the UN Office of the Iraq Program, Binan Sivan. Special thanks to Peace Watch correspondent Matthew Bradley for preparing that segment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank our listeners for your generous contributions to Peace Watch, but most importantly, thank you for your courage to seek truth in a political climate that has proven to be risky at best. For those who express their true feelings about this war, thank you for making the investment in the future of Peace Watch. Without contributions from listeners like you, we cannot provide the voices and perspectives ignored by the corporate media. Without your support, Peace Watch would be silenced. Now, more than ever before, those who support ushering peace into the world must speak up and speak out, for if we don't, if we censor ourselves, as Michael Parente reminds us, you do your enemy's work without him even having to lift a finger. Our job at Peace Watch is to provide you, the listener, with the information to make informed decisions about the world we live in. We take our job seriously so that you can do your job well. Your contributions have made it possible to continue the production of Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.